You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
This isn't your average business podcast. This is
the companion podcast for the James Altucher Show. Hosted by me, Jay the Engineer.
And me, Nathan Rossborough, the post-production manager.
So what we do is pretty much just say what we learn during that month from all the episodes. How are you doing?
Three steps behind you. I've had a wonderfully, intensely busy week in the land of publishing.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, starting a new season right now, and there are lots of celebrities coming out with books for the holiday selling season.
Oh, wait. Season as in new season of books getting sold, or like new season of books coming out?
Yeah, it's like we have a calendar that goes in three big chunks. So This is the books that are going to start going on sale between September and the end of the year are getting released now. So there's lots of... So all the celebrities who want to record all their upcoming memoirs, like people I can't say yet because it hasn't been announced.
Right.
But lots of all those celebrities, now that their books are like ready to print, they have the final manuscripts, they're all rushing to get into the studio to get their stuff recorded.
I'm totally new to this. I'm curious. Because I only know like a tip of the iceberg of this because, you know, like we do podcasts, we know roughly when people are releasing their books. So give me if I'm wrong. So people usually release their book, in April and then July and August and then December. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, those are the beginnings of season. So you have like at HarperCollins, we have a selling season that starts in January to April.
Okay.
And then a May to August. So there's a lot of books that come out at May.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of, and then throughout the summer, because you get all these summer, school lets out, everyone's going to the beach, book clubs, lots of reading. So there's a summer hump in there. And now this like September, August into September is the next wave of things that want to get on sale and marketed for the holiday season. Wait,
okay. So is different type of books come out differently, or just any type of books usually come out that three chunks?
With most big publishers, they have different imprints, like sub-record labels that are focused on their own thing to begin with.
Right.
So they're all putting roughly on the same type of release, but they're thinking about those selling seasons.
Right.
Because there's just so many books coming out, just like there's so many... It used to be when there were records. You know, you're jockeying for space.
Right.
So it's all about getting enough lead time to get all the promotion, because within the first 2 weeks or so, you basically have like 2 weeks once a book goes on sale to really capture people's attention, because every week something else is coming out and it just drops off so quickly unless it's going to be a perennial seller, you know, like a huge
hit. So is it proven like those time when the books come out sells more? Is this like something that proven, or is like people just...
I mean, we have whole sales departments that plan out these things based on market research.
What about books that come out in between? Do you think that do... significantly less or just slightly less? I'm just curious. I'm totally just curious.
It depends. I mean, it's all about looking for an opening in the market.
Right.
You're trying to position it when it's going to be prime for that particular book. And every author in theory has, you know, a marketing director, someone that's a publicist, people that are working, that are planning a date and planning the best press and marketing they can, just simply around where they feel based on the market trends.
Right.
So I don't know if there is a bad selling point. You don't want to have it at a hard time when things are hard to buy.
Or people doesn't want to spend money then because they spend so much money for their kids and for Christmas and Hanukkah and any other holidays. I have to mention all the any other holidays because I have to be inclusive. It's 2021. And well, see, this is why I'm really curious. Like James always talk about, you know, self-publish or whatever. So based on your experience or based on what you know or you think, if I self-publish, should I publish the same time as all the major publisher put out? You know, like should I publish the you know, like the casual chunks days or whatever it's called, publish days?
I think you would try to avoid any time that would be bad, just the same. Just the same as traditional publishers, you would want to avoid a bad time unless you had an angle on that. Unless you were going to be like, I'm going to put it out the week between Christmas and New Year's where maybe people got some gifts and they have some cash and I'm going to put it on sale, release it for $1, you know, just for that week. So we can get a lot of, you know, if there's a promotion angle that you could run, then there's always a best time to do something if you have an angle, if you know.
So, but it doesn't really matter.
I mean, it's all about your preparation. I think when you hire professionals to try to best market position, they're going to be most familiar with conventional, you know, sales numbers and whatnot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And also, like, I felt so ironic asking you all these questions, and I'm really interested about it because I never write any book. I never read any book. I only read comic books.
Why not?
Okay. I don't really read comic books. But this is really interesting because like I always hear people talk about how to write, what is the writing. But what about, I felt like no one talked about the process of after what happens after finish writing the book, right? So like people are like, oh, finish writing the book, what do I do now? Get covered, great design, put it on Amazon. But let's break it down. So if I finish my book and I give it to editor or whoever, edit my book, I get it back, I get the cover. When should I start record the audio version of the book, the audiobook? Because right now, I felt like writing a book is great, but it has to tack on an audio version of the book, right?
Yeah. What we found is that you want to have all editions of the book go on sale in the same day. So, so your readers are going to buy whatever version they're going to buy immediately. If you miss your on sale with an ebook, or if you don't have all of your formats on sale at the same time, you're going to just lose a part of your market because of how many books are coming out, unless people are specifically just the initial hump, right? The long tail of your book is going to be the long tail regardless because it's long.
Right.
But the initial hump, you want to be able to capitalize on all your promotion, your release day. This thing is out. You know, people probably aren't going to buy two or three copies. They're probably not going to buy two or three different formats.
Right.
So if you say my book's out and then they only listen to audiobooks and they go on Audible or go to their library and it's not there, then they're going to be like, oh, that sucks.
And they will forget about it.
Yeah.
Ah, interesting.
But you wouldn't want to record it until you have a copy of the, as close to the final as possible. With major publishers, because of the throughput of books, often a final copy, the book is still going through the final proofreading changes when we start the recording, just because of how close it gets cut to the, often books aren't, even like James's book was done, you know, he'd submitted a book, he got the title of the book, all this stuff a long time ago, but we didn't have a final copy of the final text with all this stuff until after the recording was done.
I remember the final text was, there's a lot of final version of the books. I remember like they revised the books for like a month or 2 months actually. Like constantly revising, and it's like cutting really close to the release date. If I'm not mistaken, right? It was like 2 months before the release date. Then you guys finally get into a studio, or a month. I don't remember.
That's right. Yeah, we normally deliver. We try to deliver a book from the warehouse or FDP if it's a e-agent a month before the on sale.
Right.
We set a distribution date.
Right.
And so 1 month before is when we want to start shipping things out. So everyone, all the stores that have a physical copy, if it's on CD or a hardcover, they have it. They've arrived in their warehouses. They're able to get it on the retail shelves for the day.
Right.
Right. But it was that 2 months beforehand, where there's still, you know, James is making changes to the text while he's reading it in the studio. He's going, oh, well, I already kind of said this over there, but can we cut that out of the book? You know,
like
the
editing process was. Oh, wow.
Definitely. It happens all the time when, especially when authors start reading their work aloud and listening to how it comes out spoken instead of inside their brain.
So you guys really went back and changed the text? What about the books that already been published? Not published, but already printed?
That's why it always, we got it before it went to the printer.
Oh.
And then if there's a later change, then they update the InDesign file and the next time the book gets pressed, so like the second pressing, they'll announce we're printing however many, 50,000 copies for the first printing, and that goes out on the release day. But, you know, books get reprinted so they don't go out of stock. And you can make a change. You can just send your new file to the printer. That's happening. So they say, you know, don't trash anything that's already been out there.
Right.
But the next time you print it, for the second pressing and onward, fix that typo, correct this thing. It happens all the time.
Yeah. This is so fascinating. See, I have so much question about this because I feel like this is a great topic. Even though it's a companion podcast, we're supposed to talk about James Altucher show. Fuck that, you know? We just talk about James Altucher show, you know? But this is, this is very interesting. So that I have so many directions that we can go, but I want to sort of break it down. Like, so for people that just finish a book, or people just never read a book before, or people that just curious about how the book writing process. We're not going to talk about the book writing part. The question is what happened after your book's finished written by you or blah, blah, blah. If you were to break down the whole schedule after the book is written, maybe done editing, not through audiobook yet, not through the final version yet, what would you say the next few steps or process looks like? Like, so when the book is finished reading, you go to the editor and the editor would do a bunch of editing, bring it back to you, you revise, and then what happened onwards?
Well, you're skipping a lot of steps in there.
Okay.
And sometimes it depends what the role of your editor is.
Right.
An editor is always going to be your partner in getting the book out the door.
Right.
It's somebody, it's your number one top reader, and that person is going to make comments and changes in order for them. It's a relationship where you're agreeing. It's like the producer.
Right.
You're saying, producer, I'm going to have this creative relationship with you. Mm. And it might end up, the book that comes back might be something completely different than what you went in on. And the editor for a publisher, your editor typically works for the publisher and is acquiring the contract, buying the rights. And on top of being your creative partner, they are producing it. They're saying, hey, I want to bring your work in through us. And they're holding that the budget. The editor is also holding the budget for a book.
Oh, so the editor pretty much like the producer and executive producer in that sense that like they will also A&R in a sense, right?
That's exactly right. They're the producer and the executive producer of the book.
And also A&R because they have to go out and
they're the stakeholder. Them. Everyone else on the editorial team, if it's a traditional publisher, is working for them. So the marketing and publicity department will be working directly for that portfolio of books that this editor is bringing in. They're kind of the head honcho in their own world. And at a small publisher, it's just one person and they have limited distribution.
Right.
At a big publisher, there's lots of, it's a huge pyramid.
So I'm just curious. So how often did writer and editor has a sour relationship, like as in like they break up during the process. Does that happen often, or usually the editor is just
typically not?
No, okay. So usually they would just stick with whoever the writer is.
There's a contract involved.
Okay,
so you're signing on for a certain number of books. Mm-hmm. This is where the importance of literary agents and that type of stuff, the lawyers get involved in the big traditional business, and why so many publishers don't want to accept unsolicited manuscripts is because of the, so much of the business is the business side of it.
And
working with, not mucking up that process. And they have separate smaller imprint for genre fiction. And, you know, that's where it's a lower stakes.
Right. So basically, I'm just curious, like, I assume the editor would get thousands of manuscript and they would just read it. Or do they just like sub it out? Like, hey, you read this and you filter out what do you think is good and then you give it back to me and I'm going to read all the other manuscript.
Well, that's where, you know, your literary agent beforehand is also taking a big bet because if you were an author, you would try to submit your writing sample and get a literary agent, right. Get someone to book you that knows how to talk to these people, because a literary agent's like that kind of, in that traditional model, these people, that gatekeeper, for better or worse, right. You know, that literary agent acting as a gatekeeper is the gatekeeper into the publishing world. They're the right. people that are going to be submitting your, they know how to write a book proposal contract. They know right. they have relationships with editors right. and they know how to, you know, best sell their client right. And kind of get that. So, yeah. So first, you know, is finding an editor finding an agent who would want to work with you, and then getting that pitch saying, hey, my person has a series they have in mind, and here's the one book, but we might want a 3-book contract right. because here's this arc, and here's how it could be, and here's all the comps, and all that stuff that has nothing to do with writing, like how well could it get sold, how large a writer's potential social media presence, all that stuff,
right.
that's all thought about it in the business deal that starts it.
Oh, wow.
And sometimes a person will have their book completely written, you know, it's all done, and they're like, I have this thing, right? And
right.
Like, we can do some tweaks, but here's that. And sometimes people just have a proposal. Like, James didn't have Skip the Line written when he got his book.
Yeah.
He had a book. He's like, I have an idea for the 10,000 experiments rule. And he took to his book agent, and Suzanne Gluck talked to, you know, said, here's how we can best do it. Hollis at right. Harper Business picked it up and bought the contract and said, we're buying a 1-book deal or a 2-book deal. Here's the thing. It's going to go on sale here. Here's how we'll market it. A paperback's going to come out a year afterwards. Like, whether the audio rights and the ebook rights are going to be part of the deal. Everything's like contracts and business in that model. And that's why these things take so long. And he complained about it
right.
because it's like he had a book in the form that he would typically put out to a self-published format.
Right.
And then it didn't come out until like a year later.
Right, yeah.
But it went through changes continuously until it got shipped out the door.
Yeah.
You know, he was rewriting it the whole time. Yeah. Like, there's reasons for the way things happen.
I remember there's a month, James was like, yeah, don't bother me. Don't book any podcast on that month because, you know, we already have so much in the bank. I'm like, mm-hmm. he's like, yeah, I'm going to write a book. I'm like, does it mean I'm not working this month? Or, but I mean, right. essentially, he still do all the ads and stuff. You know, I still talk to him and then we still do a bunch of different things. But so I just want to clarify, like, having your book published through a traditional publisher doesn't mean your book's going to get big in any way. You know, if you have a good book, you have a good book. You know, you've self-published is the easiest way to sort of test out the water. You know, if it's sure. a good book, because like you say, like sometimes, you know, some writer already have their book written and then they just do, mm-hmm. Make some tweak in their books and then they still can go through a traditional publisher, right?
That's right. That's a great example. And that also happens. That's not a hack, but a new road that's right. been forged in. And it's something that always existed. But in addition to book agents, big publishers will often look to small publishers or self-published works
really?
That have done well. They've done well. And it's on a small thing. We're like, hey, we can make this on a broad scope. We saw that, you know, Kamal Ravikant's Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends
right.
That was self-published and it went huge.
Up, yeah.
And then he had written another novel. He had written a book for Hachette, you know, Rebirth.
Right.
And it did pretty well. And then they republished and reworked his original book that had already been sold, took it off the market, expanded it. We did podcasts about this, you know. But that's a great example. He did a self-publishing route. He got his thing out like he wanted to.
Right.
And now the version that you buy is completely different than the other one, but it's not. It's just...
Yeah, it's just...
I don't know. It's brand like it's 2.0.
Yeah, it's just brand under thing. And also like the expanded version have more mm-hmm. stuff in there. It's almost like if you play games, there's this thing called DLC. If you buy music album, there's this thing called bonus track. You know, it's almost like that. You know, that's what happened to Robert Cialdini's book. Like his book mm-hmm. Influence came out a long time ago. And then last year he relaunched it and he rebranded it and put like more stuff in there, the expanded version. And it's more practical. You know, sometimes the newer version could be better. So this reminds me a lot of a music publishing company.
Yes, you it's know? Exactly the same. It's a very similar model.
Ah,
it's contracts and advances. It's exactly that type of thing. It's a performer.
I'm just curious. You know? You're in the industry. How many self publisher that you see made it through traditional, like got bought by a traditional publisher?
Totally the wrong person. I have no way to know. I mean, I'd love to find that answer and let you know the next time we talk.
I'm just curious.
I'm curious too.
I wonder if this is going to be like the next trend because that way the book publisher doesn't have to like spend too much money or put too much risk out there. It's just like music nowadays.
Yeah, it becomes a distribution deal instead of
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because like
you say, I want to blow this up to a big audience.
Yeah, and also like so easy to get a huge audience right now because Instagram, social media. As long as you didn't get canceled, you didn't get banned, you're fine. Just don't talk about the wrong stuff. Well, okay. So get back to the process. Now we have edit everything. Blah blah blah. Let's say the book is. Tell me, like, how many percentage the books has to be done before going to audio? For the audiobook recording, because I felt like it has to be very close because like you said, like people still constantly write it, right? So like I assume it's not 100% before you go to the audiobook.
It's typically not. So
right.
The stage at which it gets to the production process we call transmittal.
Transmittal.
And this is when James sent his Word doc of a book over to his editor. There's a date that he's supposed to send it by, a contract date. And it's like, you're supposed to send us something by this date that you've worked with your editor with beforehand to get to this point where the company is accepting it. You've transmitted the manuscript over and it's not done. It hasn't been copy edited yet. It hasn't been proofread, but it fulfills your contract. It is a book that talks about this thing. It's what your editor is like, yep, we can sell this. Like we can turn this, it's like you've created the Play-Doh that you can, or whatever. It's not done, but it's at that stage. So there's a transmittal stage. So we never go from transmittal because there can still be huge changes that happen at that stage within the process.
Right.
So it goes from transmittal, it gets sent to a copy editor, and the copy editor is just going through and fixing all the basic grammar and punctuation and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then that goes back and it gets sent to the first proofreader. And the proofreader is another person whose job is just to read through the story and make comments about like little small changes or like, oh, this, like he's sitting down here and he was standing up on the last page. So continuity errors, all those little things that might have gotten lost. And it gets sent.
Mm-hmm. Proofreader is different than market focus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So proofreader is just about the error of the book, not about like how the book should go.
It's a mix.
Okay.
The proofreader is thinking. They're making suggestions about small rewrites that could help the book get to its final stage.
Right. And then the focus group is like, oh, this book's going to be good, or this. I don't know if there's going to be ever a focus group for books at all.
I mean, there's typically someone else handling marketing that is, at a traditional publisher, there are focus groups with the retailers that happen every season. So in these sales, this is why it's structured that way. So, so you would work with your editor for a book and you decide we're going to have an on sale date in this season, right? So September to December, they pick a date. A few months before that season starts, they have a big meeting and there are sales reps from all the retailers there.
Mm-hmm.
So buyers, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, the people who are in charge of those accounts, they show up at the office. Wait. That's a benefit of having a publisher. They show up there and the editor, Hollis, in James's case, talks about all the books that are coming out in the next four months that she's editing. And it's like, gives a pitch. Here's James's book. Here's the thing. Here's who's going to buy it. Like, do you think we should change the name, the title to this? Do you think we should, do you like the proposed cover we have? Do you think we could get it to market better? Like, so they're asking the retailers, the publisher is asking the retailers,
right?
Are there changes that we could make based on the metadata structure? How many pages it is? What kind of thing? Does it have pictures in it? Whatever. They give the pitch to the retailers and say, is this cool with you? Do you think we can sell this? And they go, yeah. Or tell me more about this aspect. And things change. So so those are things that are happening, in the launch before the season. So that's still like before we go into the recording studio, they might be talking to retailers already, but the title of the book might change completely, or the cover of the book. There's lots of stuff in flux as they're getting it to like closer to market.
Do you think the focus group helps? I'm just curious. I'm totally naive. I never read a book.
I think so. I've never known it to not happen that way. You know,
really interesting.
But you know, you see how that is, and like how kind of a closed market system it is when you have. I mean, there really are gatekeepers in this model. You know, you have to get through a literary agent to get to an editor to get your book in front of the eyes of the people at retailers who are going to think if they're going to want to shelve them and how big the orders are going to be, because those companies have budgets and have to make bulk orders on books, you know, months in advance. It's a very old school system.
Yeah. It's almost like selling. I don't know what's the analogy right here, but it's almost like you're selling a car. This is a car that we're going to have. This is a computer that we're going to have. Tell me which one you want to buy, and we're going to double down on the car.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers, and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
So after that, you go into the recording studio and start record an audiobook, right?
They launch the book. They try to get some market feedback. Right. All that time, the book's going through copy editing. Mm-hmm. So they're removing all the bad punctuation and grammar stuff.
Right.
And then it goes through a few rounds of proofreading.
Right.
And so at this stage, it gets a little crazy because you're already in this time crunch right. where you've taken the market research, the copy editing, all the stuff. You got kind of a book. There's a professional proofreader that is reading the book. And they're also sending copies to the author to read. So James is reading it. And James, they're asking for author amendments. So the author is making their own kind of tweaks. And then it goes back to the editor. And the editor has to reconcile the things that the author wants or the things the author doesn't want the proofreader to do. There's two people working on it in tandem. And they're kind of like fighting to get all their stuff in to create the best product.
Right.
But that happens all the way up normally until a few weeks before the printer date. So around the second time, around the second proofreading pass is when we have felt based on historical research that we're in a place where the plot of the book isn't going to change.
Okay.
Where like a character name isn't going to change, hopefully, where they're not going to change the spelling of something, where a chapter name isn't going to change.
I'm not going to call him Billy anymore. I'm going to call him Tom from now on.
I found it. We've seen it. We've seen weird things really? Happen before.
What? Okay, okay. I have to ask, what's the weird thing that you have seen?
I've seen complete character names shift.
Okay. Do you know why? Or is that just
I don't always know why.
Oh, I'm just curious. I'm like, oh, he was supposed to be called let's say Nathan. Why did they change it to Ryan now? I wanted because they can. It could name after a real person, and then they can secure the copyright or stuff like that.
Yeah, I've seen people remove dedications in on reprints based on like cut people. Yeah.
That definitely. Sucks. Like, I hate you now. You're not going to be in my book now. I wonder if that's going to happen to me.
We often don't include dedications or acknowledgments if the author is not reading it, not narrating the book in the audio edition, simply because there's so many. Well, one, it's like these things change and it's really awkward. And then two, in acknowledgments, you end up with hundreds, 100 people who are not famous people whose names we have no clue how to pronounce. Right, right. Like, there's no, like, I can't look it up on YouTube how, you know, this person who's just a family friend from 40 years ago says their name, you know? And
what if the person's name has an exclamation mark?
Let's skip this unless…
What was it? That makes sense.
Try not to offend anyone.
That makes sense too because I felt like it's so much harder to make changes to the audio version, audio book than traditional book, right? Because like in audiobook means you have to look for audio files, hear the ad, because I felt like I skipped a couple steps, but I'm just curious, when you upload the audio files, it's not one big chunk, right? It's a lot of smaller chunks, because it's either separate out by chapters or separate out by section of the book. Correct me.
Yeah, that's right. Every retailer packages audiobooks using their own player.
Right.
So typically you are uploading one file per chapter, unless right. you want it subdivided smaller. So you're dividing each file based on what it would be in the table of contents.
Right.
If there's one if there's a sub thing in a chapter, then you might want to have that as a sub file. We make, like at my day job, I create a table of contents spreadsheet right. that accompanies the audiobook, so we can program that metadata into a database. Oh, but yeah,
that's gonna be so much work.
It's all right, you know.
This is the Excel is work. Okay, so I think this is where it's got.
So you send stuff and then it gets right. packaged. So right, yeah. But there's lots and lots of files, and right. This is why we tend now to use a central broker. We use distributor, Ingram Core Source. So we have one. So at my job, we have our own database, our digital asset management database, and then we push those files to Ingram Core Source. And Ingram has distribution deals with all of our retailers and all of our accounts, and they can permutate the files and the metadata however they need. We give them our database, and they turn everything into the needs for each publisher. So, like Apple Books want one concatenated file. That's the entire book in one MP3, and they want it with timestamps and a metadata.
Oh.
That's some in Audible, Overdrive, other retailers want things delivered per one file per chapter, especially if you're going through ACX, that type of a right. platform.
Yeah.
So they all want different things. They all want a similar thing slightly differently, so they can. Because they're big tech companies who have IT people that are their system engineers on the back end. They're not audio engineers,
right?
You know.
Right. So it's almost like CD Baby in a sense that like you push it to CD Baby and push it to all
right.
different. Okay. So this is what I want to focus on, like, because we're
out of time.
No, we're not out of time yet. Unless you have to go soon, but I'm just curious because we are a podcast, and I'm always curious about audiobooks. And if you mm-hmm. write a book, a lot of time you never think about audiobooks, which you should. You should always think about audiobooks. So now we're at the audiobook stage. What is the best way to record audio? Obviously, if you self-publish, you can secure a studio. Then don't go in a studio. Then what do you think is the best way to record at home?
Well, is the author going to be recording the book themselves, or are they going to be hiring a narrator?
That's a great question. So like, which do you find more success? I felt like if the author recorded books themselves, could prove more success, because like, oh, this is how the author sound, they know what their book is about, they will narrate it in a way that they want the book to be. But on the other hand, narrator sounds better.
Yeah. Authors often feel that they're the best people to deliver their message. And I think that is very true when they're already really good at delivering their message with their voice.
What do you mean?
Like, James is very good at recording an audiobook because he knows how to speak and tell a story. He's a speaker as well as a writer. Not all writers are good orators. Some people can write brilliantly, fluidly on the page, and when they are speaking it off of the page, it doesn't come across naturally because they just don't have that skill.
Right.
It's more than just saying names properly.
Right.
The other thing to be questioned if you want to be a narrator, the first thing you have to understand if you're going to narrate an audiobook, go sit in a closet wearing headphones for 2 hours while reading from an iPad. Just put your book or any book on a tablet, mm-hmm. right? And sit there and read it aloud for 2 hours straight.
While listening to your voice, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And do it as if you're performing. And if you're cool with it after that, imagine doing that 8 hours a day, 5 or 6 days, and really get that done and really be able to act, and that you're going to be right. able to do that better than someone else. Like, really go and practice doing that before you decide that you're the best person, because it's startling. Even myself, I listen to myself back on tape. I'm constantly editing myself, constantly. And I speak a lot more than people who have no experience speaking.
Right.
that is a prime thing that needs to be understood, because otherwise you're going to end up with something that sounds like junk or something that sounds very pristine in audio quality but is not compelling to listen to.
See, there's a reason why I didn't edit all the podcasts. I just send it to Nathan because I don't want to listen to my own voice. You know, also, like, we're not going to tell you what microphone to get or blah, 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 because that's going to be a whole new big discussion. We just want to touch on that recording a good quality of audiobooks is actually also very, very, very important. Like Nathan said before, like, if you have the stamina and if the audiobooks has good quality, people will want to share it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, so what do you think the best practice is when someone, so let's say if I am self-publishing my book, I only have $20 in my budget after I bought all my equipment. What are the best practices when I'm recording an audiobook from, like, what room should I go into and what mood should I be in?
First of all, find a quiet location. Something that's incredibly annoying is background noises that come and go, intermittent noise. So we always say to try to find an interior room. You're trying to cut down on the potential noise that's distracting from your voice.
Right.
A great way to also do that is to, when you're purchasing a microphone, I recommend for home recording, buying a dynamic microphone or a handheld condenser. A lot of times you buy a big, open, expensive mic that wants to pick up everything and you don't have a sound-treated room, or you have neighbors above or below or people running around, and that expensive mic is going to pick up your voice really well and also pick up everything else really well.
Yeah, so just to clarify, when you go there and shop for microphones, typically there are two types of microphone out there, which are condenser microphone and dynamic microphone.
Mm-hmm.
The one that Nathan suggested is dynamic microphone, which is less sensitive and more directional. And also, like, when you get the handheld one, make sure you always get a microphone stand as well, because you're not going to hold. The reason why I say microphone stand and not a tripod, because tripod usually it's too far on the table. Because you want to get as close to the microphone as possible. That's why I say a microphone stand, because it's more flexible that way.
You're going to put on some headphones, and you need to be able to record yourself and find a spot in your room and listen to what's coming back, so you can move around and find, you don't want weird booming frequencies or little weird things. None of your rooms, if there's not a studio set up, are going to sound the same. So you need to be able to really hear back what's going in and understand if that sounds similar to the really good quality that, you know, are you able to achieve when you turn your microphone up to be loud enough. Is it super noisy, or are you able to have a good clean signal that's quiet, that you don't hear stuff when it's turned up to the volume without you speaking?
One tip that you can do that is that, let's say if you have an audio editor, just ask your audio editor if he has an hour free or whatever, or you paid him for an hour, just like, hey, let's do a Zoom. I just want to try out my positions in my closet and see which position you think is the best that, you know, that wouldn't have all this other issue. Okay, so once they got all set up and start recording, what annoys you the most during the recording sessions? I think noise is the worst, because the constant noise is fine, but like the noise that pop up randomly, it's the worst.
Right. So just reducing, you know, a lot of it's risk mitigation going in. So you want to wear a soft cotton shirt or no shirt at all. Anything. Yeah, you want to have a chair that doesn't squeak. Just right. Anything that's going to remove anything that's going to make your editing harder. You know, like, here's something that people don't think about, but having a wristwatch. A lot of people don't wear analog wristwatches anymore, but a ticking watch will definitely end up in the recording. Any of those things. So listening to yourself, getting rid of all the little noises that might happen. And then inconsistent audio quality is more annoying than noises. People not staying a consistent distance from the mic or pickup sounding roomier. So like having, once you get your setup, mark down all your settings and understand it's not just the gear knob, what level it's turned to, but also if there's any switches on your microphone or if the distance you're away from your microphone. So record a snippet and have that to match the next time you go into the session,
right?
Because you're not going to get a big recording done all at once. So you have re-record the last page and listen back and forth between what you did at the end of the day before and the beginning of the next section, because you're going to notice that there's a difference in in your stamina between the end of a recording session and the beginning of the next one. Differences in slight sound between mouth noise, like needing to take a drink of water or blow your nose, which one doesn't think about except for when you're listening back, you realize how little stuffy sounds or things can really cut through. You're recording in a medium that doesn't have any video. There's nothing else to distract you. There's nothing else to take up that space. You know, full attention is being put on mouth noise.
Right.
So keeping a consistent setup where you know why your recording sounds the way it does and how to achieve it over and over again. And not, you know, if your mic is in one position and you set up, but then you decide to record the next day and you're sitting 3 feet away from the mic, even though the mic's in the same position, it's not going to sound that way. Understand that microphones, you know, become more bass sensitive as you get closer. In addition to becoming louder, that there's a element of physics called a proximity effect or a bass tip up that makes microphones more responsive to lower frequencies when they're closer to the membrane.
Well, welcome to the companion podcast Tech Talk, Audio Tech Talk. You know,
it is.
Yeah, because those are really, really important. Because like, if you start recording at a certain distance, always keep it at a certain distance. That's why I said, like, even before you know you're gonna start recording your audiobook yourself, make sure you start practicing. You know, start practicing how you react in front of the microphone. Because practice makes perfect. Like, I don't always like that. I don't always just stay in front of the microphone. I used to move around a lot, but I practice a lot. You know, I go to podcasts, I talk to myself, I play a game, I use my microphone. It's, you know, just so I know how my microphone works. You know, those are really, really important. Okay, so let's say when the recording is done, what should they think about before they send to the audio editor? And also, having an audio editor is very, very important for your audiobook. There's no way you can edit everything by yourself. You could. You're gonna burn out by the end of the process, and you're gonna hate yourself for the rest of your life, and then you're not gonna want to write a book anymore. Mm-hmm. You know.
So there are three or four other roles that could take place in the audiobook process, and sometimes these roles are held by the same person, and sometimes they're not. Is sometimes helpful to have a director or a listener, right? If not a director in the session, having somebody that you trust as a creative foil, so you might call it a producer, someone, you know, just a trusted listener to give you feedback. And that might be your editor. You might trust your editor to give you performance feedback after the fact. But you want to have someone who you have a trusting relationship, that they're not just trying to be a yes man, and they're actually going to work with you to make a good product.
Right.
So your stakeholders are going to be the director or your other creative foil in there, your editor, who's a sound editor that understands what an audiobook is supposed to sound like, the typical pacing, is somebody who listens to, who is a listener of voiceover, of podcast, and knows what things in headphones sound good and bad, and what is possible to edit and what is not possible to edit, what's better to ask to be fixed. And then you have a third person in there, hopefully an independent person who's proofreading, and they're listening to the edited files. Sometimes that's your producer as well. Someone listening back to the edited files, looking for word changes, misreads, issues that came up during the editing that need to be fixed. And then a mastering engineer, which also might be the editor. They're a person who understands the finishing touches and how to deliver your files to the specifications of retailers so that they won't reject your book when you deliver it to them.
Yeah. And also, like I have to mention, like recording audiobook is not just about reading, right? You have to put emotion.
It needs to be compelling.
It's a creative process. It's not just sit there and read. And then there's a lot of different process, different format that this can code to. Let's say if you like James wrote a skipped line, he didn't just read, Choose Yourself. Choose Yourself is a great example because he didn't just read Choose Yourself. He narrates it or he has someone ask him questions, almost like doing a podcast himself.
Yeah, he created a whole separate subsidiary format for that. Well, that's pretty cool too.
Yeah.
But it's good to have, I think a lot about suspension of disbelief as being very important in audiobooks. It's important across all medium, but suspension of disbelief means you are listening to what you're listening to, what you're reading. You believe you're in that world. You're not constantly thinking, "Oh, I'm reading a book." You're involved in the story. And with movies, I mean, in every format, people are thinking of it. But as an audiobook being a performed, voice-recorded version of a book, that's where you need to have all your shit together, because everything can be well-written in the book. But if you have a poor performance, if you're like, if there are character voices and you can't do it well, if you can't be cohesive, if you're saying the wrong names of proper nouns that you've written in your book, like showing that you're not an expert, you don't really know what you're talking about. If you're talking about place names a lot, but you don't know what that place is actually called, you end up sounding like an idiot. It's just whatever is going to break the audience's spell and make them be like, oh, wait.
The most famous example would be Benedict Cumberbatch pronouncing penguin.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yes. All of a sudden you're thinking about the person performing instead of the thing, right? If you're focused on the performance instead of, if you're focused on how the performer is performing as opposed to what you paid, the media you paid to enjoy, you done fucked up.
Yeah. So that's very important. And also, like, always find new creative to narrate your books. You know, like, I get it. Like, if you wrote a novel, I felt like novel is a little bit hard to narrate. I felt like novel has a couple people to narrate. You know, like, as for novel, you can have narrator. Narrator done best when narrating a novel. You know, or is it fiction? Fiction is fake, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or fiction books. You know, but nonfiction is best if you narrate it yourself, because you've done the research, you wrote the book. Unless you ghostwrite, I don't know.
Author narrated nonfiction can be the best if the author can compelling read, if they,
right.
But really do it. Make sure not just that you aren't the best person just in your head, but you still sound like the smart person you are who wrote this book when you're listening back to the audio of yourself, that you're not going to make a fool of yourself.
Right.
Like, there's no reason to. Yeah.
Also, if you were to hire a narrator, don't hire Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'll be back. Yeah. Well, so, okay, after mastering and after everything, so let's say if the writer did rewrite some sections, so it sent back to the editor and they cut stuff out, and then do they still go into the studio after?
It depends how many times it takes to get happy with the final product.
Yeah.
And also, but you might send back and forth a number of times until the all the corrections are fixed.
Yeah, and also this happened to our session before. Always have a backup. Always have a backup. When you record everything, always have a backup. And make sure if you record yourself, make sure it's recording, please. Make sure you hit the button.
Make sure there's a company called Zoom that's different from Zoom Software.
Mm-hmm.
They make handheld recorders and whatnot that are great. Most of them have microphone inputs.
It's the same company,
inputs.
No?
No, they're different companies.
Really? I thought it was the same company, different division.
Yeah, different companies. Zoom, the company that makes podcasting and audio recording equipment, for just $100 or so, you can buy a very good recorder that is recording independently to an SD card. It doesn't matter if your hard drive breaks. It doesn't matter. You have a separate recording that's getting split off before the computer, not just backing up your hard drive, having a redundant recording. Right now, we're doing this podcast. Jay is recording his audio on his computer. I'm recording my audio on my computer, and we're recording in the cloud, the combined Zoom thing. So if one of them, if something breaks, we have another copy already. And it's so easy to not fuck up just by making sure that you plug into a backup recorder and have a second thing running in parallel as opposed to after the fact. Hey. After the fact's no good.
Yeah, you
after
say
the fact's
it's
not a real backup.
You say it's easy. Trust me, that's a lot.
It's
of
easy
fuck
to
up
fuck
all
it
all
up
time.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's easy on both ends. Yeah, because like the words it would be like after a recorder and then come back, you're like a month later, you're like, crap, I don't have this. I have to record this again. And you totally lost the space. You know, it's very hard to get into space, anymore. So, okay, after everything, after we write.
It costs a lot less to get a backup the first time.
Yep. And so after everything, after the audiobook is done, after we write, it gets pushed to the platform, right?
Mm-hmm. And then you have, after it's all done, then you have either through your publisher or independently through a broker worked out a distribution deal with a company or a number of companies.
Okay, so this is a fascinating question.
What stores are you going to sell it? That's the question.
Yeah. Because like, if I'm independent, if I self-publish, I don't know about finding a distributor. You know, like, mm-hmm. is there any like software out there, like CD Baby sort of thing that I can?
Yeah. So there are a number of companies that do this stuff really easily. Audible is the biggest retailer in and of itself, yes. and they have a very well established. Independent publishing platform called ACX.
Yep.
They started a number of years ago, which is both the marketplace for narrators and authors to buy and sell rights and to work with one another. And also it's a distribution platform for people to sell their books in the same way that like CreateSpace, you know, on the Amazon.
I thought that only blasts to Audible, right? It doesn't blast to any other platform?
Well, that's the thing. So you can have an exclusive deal with Audible through ACX, or you can have a non-exclusive deal. One can make that choice.
Right.
You can use the ACX platform exclusively or non-exclusively. If you're using it exclusively, then Audible, then they pay you a higher percentage royalty share on the sales. I think something as high as 70%. They say which is great. And it's more of a 50% royalty model across the board for most retailers if you're doing a non-exclusive model, but you're widening your net. So right. there are different brokers. There's company Findaway that does this, and there's
Findaway.com.
Yeah. So there are a number of these brokers that that are companies that akin to CD Baby who take a small fee. But they act as the front platform to receive and then push everything to everywhere. And in a lot of cases, they'll handle your accounting and royalty payments if you have separate rights holders. So if you right. had a co-author or if you had someone else that needs to receive money on a recurring instead of an upfront, these are dashboards you can use. But generally, you're going to end up with a 50% royalty share, something in that market. But you'll be able to tap into the library market through Overdrive and a lot of I think hitting the library market is a very important way to, especially for nonfiction texts, to get your book around, be able to get people to not use their one Audible credit a month to buy it, but
right.
getting distribution that's going to end up in their public library through the Libby app or through Overdrive, which people are more used to using now than previous years.
Oh, interesting. So, okay. So once it's done, when you upload to ACS, you have to set the publish date. So you want to set the publish date the same as your books go on sale.
Right. Having one big marketing push for all editions of your book make the most sense. So if you're going to pay someone for marketing promotion, plan a big huzzah, you might as well make sure everything's available on that day so you don't have to keep trying to create buzz for your book.
Right. Okay. So is that the final step? Once that go on sales and that's it.
And then you just need to get a nonprofit to like purchase 100,000 copies of your book.
Why?
Because this is how political organizations get their people on the bestseller list. So like a famous example is Donald Trump Jr. had a book come out, I think during 2020, and the Republican National Committee, or one of the super PACs, basically bought tens of thousands of copies of the book that they were then giving away as like gifts for people who donated. But it had the impact of on that first week of sales, getting a huge bulk amount of sales through one thing, which shoots them to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. So they're gaming their way to the top by having a shell company buy copies of their book. They're cheating their way to the top.
Wait. So if I'm self-published, how can I do this? Like,
you just got to get a rich person. So like James is a millionaire, right?
Is he a millionaire? I didn't know he is a millionaire. Oh my God. He should pay me more. What?
So if you could convince James that it would be beneficial that you're on the New York Times bestseller list, you could self-publish a book and be like, James, can you, through some shell company, blah, 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 the choose yourself list, buy enough copies of my book that you're going to get me on the charts?
Right.
And make a compelling case to someone with money to go scam you up there.
Did that really help?
Yeah, of course.
Being
that's
being
why
a list help.
What?
I mean, like, yeah, I don't know. Definitely. Being a New York Times,
there is not one book that James has that does not say Wall Street Journal bestselling author on the cover, along with his name.
Right.
If it didn't matter, he wouldn't put it on there.
Right.
People want to know, have something that says, oh, this person must be good because they've made it to the top of this list that we call a list of record.
Right. I guess there's also the credibility bias, right?
Like, that's right.
People that see that are like, there's a huge
gamification to the system that can be done.
Yeah. It's all about the money.
It's all about the money.
It's all about the money and the politics, you know? Like, mm-hmm. Maybe I can get Donald Trump to buy my book, you know, because, you know, people hate him. So, like, it's going to be hot news and it's going to be on the list. So, you know.
Well, like Don Jr. for the rest of his life, he will always be able to say New York Times bestselling author Donald Trump Jr.
Right.
No matter what he writes, he can put that. And like, so they got it out of they took care of that while that person was at an apex of his political, you know, to date, is the most politically, publicly active, you know?
Right. Yeah. And also, like, you don't have to be on the list for a long time, right? Just once. Just have a hit for one
just for,
week.
For just That's one it. Week. Yep.
Yeah, that's it. I'm on there. Holy shit. And so what's next after being on top seller list? And then, just go
fix
podcast,
it in the
right?
review. Fix it in the review. Yep.
Fix what?
Fix it in the review. If there's anything messed up in the book, you fix it in you tell the person, I'm just kidding about this, but you pay off the person reviewing it and then they write a good review and then people buy it anyway.
All the time?
I mean, I think that probably I'm not involved anyway in book sales, only book production, and so I'm just bullshitting.
But I felt like
I'm sure, like, it sounds like payola, you know?
Yeah, it could happen in any industry.
Yeah, you know, it has happened in every industry, so I'm sure it happened in book publishing.
Yeah, also, like, sometimes you don't pay for them to write for you. You can be like, hey, we are friends, right? Do you want to write a good review about it, you know? You're good friends,
blurbing.
You know?
Blurbing.
Yeah, and I buy you some, you know, PS5, or hey, you have a kids, you know, only money, you know.
That's
bribery. You know, bribery comes in any form, you know, depends on your on the intentions.
That's right.
So that's great. And then I think right now isn't the best way to push the book, isn't it, going on the podcast, like coming onto the companion podcast or something like that?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So that's great. Holy shit. I thought we're gonna do a whole company podcast for the James Harden show, but I feel like this
is more interesting.
Yeah. We didn't talk about what we learned for the past week. I think we'll include the past week for the next one. But this is very interesting. So if you're out there, if you're writing a book, if you think about writing a book, if you don't want to go to a gatekeeper, so like as we realized, there's a couple ways to do it. If you don't want to go through a gatekeeper, write a book first, self-publish, get however much exposure that you can get, make, like, you know, like, just have a shit ton of people buy a book or get a shit ton of followers, and then, you know, if the book, and then I'm sure once you write a book, you will have a connection to a book publisher or whatever, and then you're like, hey, see, this is my book, it came out this time I got sold this many. You pitch them. And then maybe they will want to buy it. Once they buy it, you know, you get more money or not. Who knows? And then, you know, that's a good... I felt like that's probably the best route to go, go past the gatekeeper, right?
It depends if your goal is to make a living as a writer.
Right.
There are lots of reasons to do lots of creative things. And what you've just explained and what we've spent the past hour and a half explaining are ways that traditional books and self-published books kind of intersect, and the ways to do that if your goal is to make money and get attention, which is the industry that pays me to work in it.
Right.
But there's also very legitimate non-commercial reasons to do things like just wanting to be published, or, I mean, just getting your voice out, or wanting to work with an editor because you like who else they've worked with, even if it's not going to get you money, just being able to achieve your goals as a writer. It's not always about sales, even you might want to write something without trying to, you know, market yourself, and just because you like writing things and want to get it out.
Right. I think that's right too. Also, I felt like it's definitely a legitimate reason to write a book as a name card. So like, you wrote a book in the topic that you believe in, like, hey, I'm an expert in this topic, and this is my book, read it, see if you like it or not, you know?
Exactly. The spoken wheel approach in that regard. Yep. Cement yourself as an expert. Get your ideas down in a format that's consumable and you can instantly hand and be like, here's my ideas. Read them at your own leisure. But you like they are, I do have actual ideas.
Right.
And I've written a whole book about it.
So if you have an idea about any books, just write it. And you know, like of course, you know, this podcast is not, we didn't tell you how to write a book. We didn't say like, if you want to know how to write a book, you know, James has a couple episodes on the James Altucher Show talk about self-publishing. You can write all those books. This is just us talking about the process. What happened after you have a book? What happened when after you write a book?
Yeah, the production process.
You, yeah, to really succeed. I wouldn't say succeed. To write a good book, you should really know how a process works, so you wouldn't get confused, or if any agent want to like sort of like, you know, lie to you or whatever, at least you know how the process like. And also we focus on how the audio book should sound or should be and what you should do, which is really, really important, which is something that I really care about and Nathan care about, because this is what we do, you know. And if you have any questions, I don't know, Nathan, you still have no Twitter account.
Next time, can reach out next to. Week, I'll be
next
back.
Week, yeah, next week or 2 weeks from now, you know, Nathan's going to have a Instagram account or Twitter account. And if you have any audio questions, you can reach out to me and ask me, you know, on Twitter. I'm at JAY_YOW07, JYOW. And I always tag James on everything. So you will see me and James all the time. Yeah, this is great. I didn't expect it to be this way. I came on. I'm like, I'm burned out. I just want to talk something else other than James. You know, no one want to talk about James anymore. No, I'm just kidding. We love James. But yeah, I think this is great. I think this provides a lot of value to people that already wrote a book and like
want to get it produced.
Yeah. Want to get it produced, or what's the next step? Anything to add, Nathan?
It's great seeing you, buddy.
It's great seeing you too. I miss you. I miss the beard.
Yeah, it's coming back.
It's coming slowly. Back. Yeah. You have to go to winter time. So
yeah,
no
exactly.
Shave. What's called no shave.
Movember.
Yeah. Anyway, till next time. Thanks for listening to the show. If you have any questions, tweet at Jay Altucher. You know, like if you think this is great, tweet at Jay Altucher. Say how good of a job that we do, so he will appreciate us more.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.